The Bible reading this morning is from Genesis, nice and easy to find if you've got the Bible in your pew. It's the first chapter of the first book of the Bible, and we're starting at verse 25, and we're actually starting at verse 26, I lied, 26, and we're going into chapter 2 down to verse 3. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Then God said, "I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food." And it was so. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he'd been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. This is the end of this morning's reading. The rest of chapter 2 goes on to talk about Adam and his creation. But it'd be kind of interesting, wouldn't it, if we had Adam here this morning, who could kind of tell that story as he might have experienced it.
Well, I can confirm, ladies and gentlemen, that it is raining outside and I am well watered, but I'm looking forward to spending some time in God's Word with you. How about I pray for us before we get into it? Heavenly Father, we praise you that you are the maker of all things, that because of you we have our existence, and that we owe all our meaning and all our purpose to you. We thank you that you are not only the Creator God, but you are a God who talks to us, that you want us to know your purposes and you want us to know yourself. And we ask that we would learn more about you, about your purposes for us, and we would obey what we hear as a result of coming under the authority of your word today. It is in your Son's name that we pray. Amen. Well, it is reasonably certain that beginnings matter. The way things start, the way things originate, is really important. In 1977, a movie opened with a piece of rolling text. And after it said one bit of text, the next bit of text said, "Episode 4. This was Star Wars, beginning at episode 4. Now, for a short period, we were okay with starting at episode 4. But after a while, our curiosity started to agitate within us, and we demanded to know what went before. You just don't start at episode 4. Now, the fact that George Lucas has made such a bad job of making episodes 1 and 2 does not take away from the fact that it is legitimate to find out how the story began, and we may pray episode 3 is somewhat of an improvement. Sorry if you like them. The reason is beginnings matter. The way a story starts affects everything. That's why most of us who went to see Lord of the Rings 2, The Two Towers, had already seen The Fellowship of the Ring. Things just don't make sense when you start stories in the middle. I don't know what happens in your family, but I haven't had the frequent experience of my childhood where my mother would walk in on a TV program, which I've been watching from the start, but she would come in halfway. Now, my mother had to come in halfway because she was usually cleaning up after me or doing something on my behalf. So she was working hard for me. I want to clear her name on that respect. That's why she was late to the program. But nevertheless, she entered in the middle. Now, my mum is a curious old cat, and she's never been afraid to ask a question, and she was never afraid to ask them right there and then. And so it began. Who's that guy? Why do they hate each other? What's the deal with his dog? And so it went on and on and on. Drove me nuts. Finally, I'd often flip out, as youthful teenagers will do, and said, "Mum, you need to watch the program from the start. If the good Lord could provide me with a time machine, I'd set it back half an hour. We could watch it together, but he can't, so please be quiet." She usually wouldn't be, because she understood. Nothing makes sense, or not a whole lot makes sense, unless you start at the beginning. Such a principle can sometimes equally be applied to our personal lives. We love talking about our past when we catch up with one another. In fact, one of the fun things that people do is when there's a group of people who've been friends for a while, or a married couple, or someone who's going out, one of the frequent questions we love to ask is, "So how did you guys get together?" And we love hearing the stories. It's intensely fascinating, but sometimes we see in the way that people got together some sort of foreshadowing of the way that the relationship was going to travel. From the start, we knew. When I first declared my affections for the lovely Linda, she was very nervous. There was considerable anxiety, and she later confided in me that she thought I was a nerd and a dork. And 5 years down the track, nothing much has changed. The way it started is the way it's continued, and I thank God for it. We all know it to be true. Knowing the beginning of a story helps you understand the rest of it. Beginnings matter. In fact, good stories always start with something that helps you work out the character's identity and work out the character's place. And they're the two things I want to look at in terms of yourself and Genesis, your identity and your place according to the Bible. If you like, you can put it as two questions. Who am I and where am I? You see, contrary to popular demand, Genesis 1 and 2 is not primarily about the creation evolution debate. It could contribute to that debate, I do not deny that, but it's just not really about science. It's about far more important things. Things like the glorious God who created you, the relationship he wants to have with you, the plans and the purpose that he has for you, and your identity and your place in this world. And you can see that from the start, because the first four words of Genesis are, "In the beginning, God." It doesn't start with a scientific equation. It doesn't go, you know, X equals, and that's the first line of Genesis. It's "In the beginning, God." You get introduced to who made the world. And you must understand, beyond any other detail that we try and work out or figure out, that God created the world out of his own choice. It didn't happen spontaneously. It didn't happen by any necessity. He chose it. It happened. That's the thing you need to understand. He made it all, and it's all made for him. Our glorious God made the world, and it exists for the purposes of his glory. As Psalm 19 declares, the heavens are telling the glory of God. All creation gives God praise, and that is the whole point. Yet whilst it's true that all of creation testifies to God's glory, as you proceed through Genesis 1, you get the feeling that something big is being prepared to happen. Sun, moon, stars get made, land, sea, fish, animals. But you get the sense that there is a big moment on the way. That almost a home is being prepared for someone, a place for a person to enjoy. Now, alarm bells are ringing in your head. There's a unique creature on the way. And Genesis 1 tells us about that unique creature. Genesis 1:26. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Humanity is the apex of God's creation. Now, please don't get me wrong when I say that. It is not that the rest of the creation is unimportant. In fact, all throughout Genesis 1, God is continually going, that's good, that's good, that's good, that's good. But it is not until humanity is created that God goes, that's very good. So whatever it is, we are special in some sense. But what is it about us in general? Because we do differ so much. Whether it be age or race or lifestyle, what is it about us as human beings that makes us special? A little girl, climbed up onto the lap of her aging grandmother one day and looked at her and just kind of peered at her face and looked at the white hair and the wrinkles, and she just said, Grandma, did God make you? Yes, darling, God made me. Grandma, did God make me? Yes, he made you too. Don't you think he's doing a better job now? You see, what is it that means that the grandmother and the little girl, no matter how different they look and how much different experience and how many different lifestyles and all that kind of stuff, what is it that is unique and common about them as human beings? Well, God tells us in Genesis 1:26, he pinpoints your identity. He says, you're in his image and his likeness. Now, if you ever want to get Christians to have a fight, which I don't recommend, but if you ever do, here's one of the topics to throw up amongst them. Just go, toss it in like this. Just go, what do you reckon the image of God and humanity is? And then run. Because people have got so many different ideas about what the image of God and humanity is. What people tend to do is they try and find anything that's unique about humans with relationship to animals, and then they say that must be the image of God. So, take for example our ability to think and reason. People say, well, that must be the image of God because monkeys don't do algebra. Most humans don't do algebra, but that's not the point. You see, we could if we wanted to. And so it must be our thinking. But the text doesn't suggest that. The ancient reader wouldn't have picked that up. Another suggestion is that the image of God must be our ability to relate to God in a special and unique way. Now, absolutely, I believe the image of God is one of the reasons we can do that. But I don't think that's what the image of God is in us. Because we need to understand things in terms of the view that the original hearers would have heard this in. We tend to import our notions onto the image of God. We need to read them out of the Bible. Now, to understand this, you just need a little bit of a history lesson. I won't bore you for long. In the ancient world, you did call things images. When you said something was an image of something else, what it meant was you were looking at something that was a representation of something else. Give you an example, take a statue. Statue of a god or a king, you walk past the statue of the god and king, you would have said, that's an image of the god or the king. Okay? And you would say, it represents him. I know it's him. I know it's representing him and it's kind of doing something on his behalf. Now, I had a modern example here, but I've left it over in the office. My wife has a dashboard Elvis. Does anyone else have any of these? They're little annoying things that hang and obstruct your vision at crucial points in your driving pattern. But that little suction cap on top, and there's a little Elvis, and he dances on a spring, and people who like Elvis really like it. And he represents a kind of a king, so to speak, of rock and roll. You know, you see him and you go, that's Elvis. Now, it doesn't mean that the image actually represents everything about the person. For example, if I was to take the dashboard Elvis, I don't believe that everything about the dashboard Elvis translates to Elvis. For the first thing, it's thin. The second thing is, it's made of plastic. The third thing is, it's 15 centimetres high. And the fourth thing is, it's got a spring for a rib cage. Now, I don't necessarily translate all those things over to the real Elvis. okay? Because I understand that little statuette only represents him in some ways. So when it says we're in the image of God, it doesn't mean we represent God in every way, like we're a photocopy of God. It means we just represent God in some ways. In some ways. But how do we reflect him if it's not to do with our arms and legs and body, because God is spirit, and it's not to do with our mind necessarily, and it's not necessarily to do with our relationship with God? What is it? Well, here's the next bit of history I have to understand. There was only one person in the ancient world who you would ever describe as being in the image of God. In the ancient Near East, uniformly across all the evidence from like Assyria and Babylon and Egypt and all those kind of places, only person you would ever say is in the image of God is the king. And here's how the logic works. God is the ultimate ruler of the world. I understand that. But what I see in front of me is that the king rules. Therefore, the king must be ruling on God's behalf. Makes sense? God rules, but then there's this king who rules as well. So he must be ruling on his behalf. Therefore, that king, he's in the image of God. And that's all you get from the ancient world. So when the original readers of Genesis would have heard this, that's what they would have heard. They would have heard image of God. That's a royal term. That describes kings. And now you're asking, where are the kings in this particular text? Well, you're the kings. You're the queens. You're the royalty. Let me unpack it for you. Psalm 8 says that we are crowned with glory and honor. And it's talking about our creation. And got tongue tied there. If you notice in the text, when it says they were created in the image of God, look at what comes straight after it. What does God say about our function? Let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth. The two follow logically. If you're in the image of God, you're a king. And therefore, you must rule over something. And what has God put us over? The entire earth. It keeps on saying it in verse 28. Humans are to rule the earth. They're to subdue it. They're to have dominion. They're to fill the earth. Those are the things that rulers do. That's the things that kings would do. Our purpose is that we are God's appointed representative to rule the creation on his behalf. It's not like God doesn't rule himself. It's just that he puts us up on an incredible pedestal and says, you're the kings of creation. You take care of it. Now, at this point, some of you are probably feeling a little uncomfortable about this idea. We're the kings of creation. And the reason you're probably feeling uncomfortable about it is that you recognize that far from ruling creation wisely, we have destroyed it. There are some thinkers, notably a guy in 1967, who basically argued that the environmental crisis was totally the result of Genesis 1. That everything that is wrong with our world is basically because we've got this worldview that we are the kings of creation. And so what we've done is we've gone and just completely ruined the world. That might be true. Some people might have misused it, but it's not what God intends. See, the idea is not if you're a king of creation, you're a tyrant of creation, so that you go, let's just have an oil spill, because we can. We rule the earth. It's our right. That's not it at all. You see, you rule because you're in the image of God. And if you're in the image of God, you rule like he would rule. And God is no abuser of the earth. He thinks the earth is a good thing. Indeed, in the book of Revelation, one of the categories of sinners, one of the categories for judgment, is for those who destroy the earth. Chapter 11 in Revelation. God cares a heck of a lot about this creation. And so our purpose is to rule over creation the way God would rule over it, to represent him, to reflect him, so that all the rest of creation could look at us and go, I get an idea about what God is like. Indeed, in Genesis 2 verse 15, when God puts mankind in the Garden of Eden, it says he's there to take care of it. You see, our image of kingship is so much like of absolute monarchs or tyrants that we need to understand that Jesus is the ultimate king in the New Testament, and as a king, he served. And so we are to be servants of the creation, not to worship it, but to take care of it. Who are you? You're a human being. You've been crowned with glory and honour. You've been given an extraordinary dignity, and therefore you stand in a special relationship with God. And we need to hear that, because our culture destroys dignity. And we need to understand from the very beginning, we had dignity. I was listening to ABC Radio the other day, and they're having a little forum on what's going on in Baghdad at the moment. And Geraldine Doog was on it. And they were discussing the looting in Baghdad. And Geraldine Doog made this really weird comment. She went, I was really surprised by the looting. I thought we were beyond that in the modern world, that kind of like when law and order, you know, descended into chaos, that it'd all fall apart and we'd all go steal everything. She goes, I just thought we were beyond that. I didn't think we were so base and lacking in dignity. And I just went, hello? Have you watched the TV lately in your own culture, Geraldine? Like, this is the culture that has Jerry Springer. It has The Bold and the Beautiful. The Bachelor. It's time to pull the log out of our own eyes, folks, and stop pointing the finger at the nasty citizens of Baghdad. We don't know dignity, let alone an Iraqi. It's the world we live in. Human beings live dishonorably. But you need to remind yourself from the start you were made with dignity and given a position of excellence, a position of honour. Well, that's our identity. But I said in my introduction that good stories put us, enable us to understand our identity and our place. And I want to move on to the question of place now. The question of where am I, according to Genesis. Now, Genesis gives two answers to this, because there's where you were and where you are now. But it's always good to know where you are, just as a general principle. But it's particularly important for me. And I've had to learn this in a rather interesting way, because I have a strange sleeping ailment. Yes, Shani knows what I'm about to talk about. When I am very tired, I occasionally go into a zone which I like to call half sleep, which is where you're not fully awake and you're not fully asleep, but you kind of do things from both worlds. So you dream, but you're in the real world, which I think is called hallucinations, but I don't want to be like looked at like the guy from A Beautiful Mind or like a drug addict, so just we won't call it hallucinations or stuff like that. But that's what I do. I kind of have these moments where, like, you know, I'm interacting with something, but it's actually not there. And my wife loves it. I ask her about it sometimes. She'll keep you for about half an hour. And I get lost. And I came back from the States a few weeks ago, and I'd been on the road for 24 days and just traveling all the time. I got home, and I just knew I was going to have one of my freaky sleepy episodes. And so when I went to sleep, and what do you know, I went in a half sleep or whatever it is, and I just absolutely forgot where I was. Like, I was dreaming, but nothing was kind of happening, but I just had no idea where I was. And so I got up and I walked around my own unit, which I've lived in for 2 years, and opened every door, drawer, curtain, window, and just, where am I? I don't know. Am I in England? I don't know if I'm in England. Am I in England? My wife talked to me in the morning. She goes, what were you doing last night? I said, I didn't know where I was, darling. I didn't know where my home was. It's always important to know your location, to know your place. Well, according to Genesis, where's your place? Well, as I said, it tells you where you used to be and where you are now. In terms of where you used to be in an astonishingly wonderful place. Genesis 1:31, God looks on his creation and he says it's very good. But the real beauty of the place we're in is described in chapter 2, when it says, by the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it, he rested from all the work of creating that he'd done. For 6 days, God has been on the go, creating order out of chaos. But when he gets to his final creation, which is man, he doesn't finish. He's finished creating, but he hasn't reached his end. There's a seventh day to come. On the seventh day, God does no work. Indeed, it says he rests. Now, he doesn't rest because he's tired. God doesn't get tired. God rests because he's finished. You rest when you've done a job well. And he rests on the seventh day because the job is done. The job is finished, and God goes, it's very good. And so that is the day of rest. And he blesses it. No other day in the entire creation scheme gets blessed, but the seventh day gets blessed. That was his goal. He made the world in 6 days in order that we might experience the seventh. Because we tend to think about it in terms of the Sabbath that comes later. You know, 6 days work, 1 day off, 6 days work again. Yeah, God doesn't go back to work. God takes it off forever. There's no eighth day of creation. He doesn't start up again. Look at the text. There's no morning and evening on the seventh day. It doesn't end. The seventh day is meant to continue forever. We are meant to experience God's rest forever. Now, you're probably going, what are you talking about, Mark? Are you basically implying creation was made so that we could have a weekend all the time? Creation was made so that we have a day off forever? No, this is where you need to revise your notions of what the word rest means. The seventh day is the day of his rest. God rests because he's finished. He doesn't need to do anything more. And what he wants us to do is to experience the goodness of all that he has made and all that he is in that context of rest. He's resting because he's finished, and he's inviting us to share in what he's made. Indeed, rest is kind of one of those summary words. It kind of implies all of those blessings that come about that you see in Genesis 2, which are things like fertility and prosperity. And you see at the heart of it three relationships that are such a blessing, that are at the core of what it means to experience God's rest. The first of these, of course, is relationship with God. There is a harmonious relationship between human beings and God, and such that in Genesis 2 it's described that mankind can walk in the garden with God and chat with him. The second picture of relational harmony is relationship or harmonious relationship between human beings and one another. Okay. One commentator has said Adam and Eve had the ideal marriage. He didn't have to hear about all the men she could have married, and she didn't hear about how well his mother cooked. It was a perfect relationship. There's another relationship that's harmonious there, which is that our relationship with creation works, because there's no thorns and thistles kind of coming out of the ground to frustrate our purposes of ruling it. The blessing of God's rest is the enjoyment of everything in right relationship. That's the place we were in, the place of God's rest. It's a good place to be, but we're not there anymore. Genesis 3 narrates the great rebellion of humanity against God's rule. Most of you know the details. Charles enacted it a bit for us. We reached out and grabbed hold of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And beyond any other detail you want to know about that, it is a symbol of our turning our trust away from God. We choose to trust the word of a serpent, the member of a creation that we're meant to rule, instead of listening to the God who made us. And so we rebel against him. And as a result of that, we are cast out of that blessed place of rest. And that's where we live now, and it all unravels. That one supposedly little act, it just all starts to fall apart. And if you go on and read chapter 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 and 10 and 11 of Genesis, it's just really depressing, because it's just a spiral of violence and sin. Now, there are many more moves to come in the Bible storyline. Indeed, that's what the rest of this series is about. So I really won't finish, so to speak. No, I will finish the sermon. Sorry, that probably put heart palpitations through most people, but I won't be finishing the story today. There's many more moves to come in the Bible storyline, but you've got to feel the darkness of this moment to have so much and to have lost that place. We're no longer in Eden. God still blesses and cares for this world, but we are no longer in the place where there is harmony in relationships. We're in a world filled with violence and disharmony. As the Hungarian proverb puts it, Adam ate the apple and our teeth still ache. And we long to get back to a place like Eden. We long to get back to a place where there's blessing, a place where God's rest is experienced. And who am I in this paradise lost world? You're still the image of God. We don't lose that when we sin. Genesis 9:6, James 3:9, both say we retain the image of God. We still have the glory and honor of being created to be God's kingly representatives on earth. But we are of the line of Adam, and we know that we have a defect, and that defect is sin, and it stops us from being the people that God has made us to be. We can't fulfill the role. We can't live up to the incredible heights it is to be God's kingly representative and ruling wisely. And so in light of our inability to save ourselves, our hopes turn to the idea that there will be another Adam, a second Adam, who where we failed, he triumphs. Where we fell apart, he doesn't fall apart. Where we ruled unwisely, he rules wisely. Is it possible that just as one man's mistake saw paradise lost, so one man's perfect life will see humanity restored and returned to the place of God's rest? But I'm getting ahead of myself. Stay tuned for the rest of the story.